In a mess of life, which I have hinted might be considered to be his magnum opus, you see this attitude toward music in its fullest development. It is, from beginning to end, a work of affirmation, a celebration of earthly things, what people are doing, and it is a hymn of joy. That does not mean the joy is expressed all the time in riotous sound and jovial and exhilarating accents. It is not. There are moments of extreme power. There are moments of high exaltation. But a great deal of the mass is emotion remembered in tranquility, to use the words of Wordsworth. Rumination in nature, sitting by streams, alone upon mountain heights, or in forest gloom or silence. The mass begins by what I've called affirmation of life. It is, in its first number, what might be called a hymn to the power of the all-conquering will to overcome obstacles which lie across the path of achieving spiritual success or triumph. It is, one may say, a belief in the power to conquer such obstacles. Then we have a picture of earthly pleasure, but expressed in exquisite music. Finally, an apotheosis of the dance itself, which the author of the poem, Nietzsche, regarded as one of the most attractive and most human diversions and manifestations. Then we have a characteristically Delian episode, the eventide, and the gentler emotions aroused by the oncoming of eve, the slow descent of darkness, the songs of lovers, and the murmurs of nature around. We then have a little orchestral interlude, which might be termed, although it has no actual title, Upon the Mountain Heights. It is three solo horn parts, two of which are heard in echo, just as one can imagine or even hear sound in high places, coming to our ears and then being heard once again from a farther distance. We then proceed from there to another grand explosion, if I may use the word, of joy in discovery, in adventure, in seeking new paths and breaking fresh ground. That is followed by a highly contrasted episode of some length, too, of tranquility in meadows. Once more we hear the murmur of trees, the gentle sound of brooks, and also the almost sublime feeling of content on the part of the onlookers and hearers of pleasure derived from the contemplation of such beauties. We eventually arrive at the termination of this extraordinary piece, and we hear for the last time, but in its extended form, what might be called the leading theme or motto of the whole composition. I'll play you a few notes of it in a moment. It made its appearance early on. Fragments of it are to be heard by way of auxiliary or contrapuntal assistance to the main theme of the moment. But now it emerges fully into the light of our attention. This theme, although, as I say, it makes its appearance in full at the very end of the work, is the oldest part of the composition and dates back to about 1897. The composer's wife has told us, or rather communicated to me in a letter, how it came into his head. She and a friend were sitting in a room of his house, a Grey sur Loing, near the forest of Fontainebleau in France, talking quietly, when they heard the voice of Frederick, alias, calling them. And they went downstairs to his music room, where he was sitting at the piano. And he said, I want to play you an idea which has come into my head for a setting of certain words of Friedrich Nietzsche's Zarathustra. He then played the theme, which you're about to hear, of which the words, German words are, O Mensch, gib acht, was bricht die tiefe Mitternacht, which in the English version goes, O man, mark well what tolls the solemn midnight bell. This theme I will do my best to play you. Very unsatisfactory, I'm afraid, because the score is essentially orchestral, and I am possibly one of the world's worst pianists. There follows the real finale of the work, of which the text is, or the burden, joy is far greater than grief. Let grief go, and let us live henceforth in joy. Joy the greatest and most compelling, most vital force in the world. And that is our creed. That is the message of a mass of life, both from the author of the text and its composer, Frederick Delius. A final word about Delius himself and his position in music. It is too early, of course, to assess him at his exact value. But one can do so in relation to what we call English or British music. And I think the most and best I can say about Delius is that between the time of Purcell and Delius himself, we had no British composer who lived consistently in the realm of beauty of sound. Delius was the composer in England who brought back to our national music, if there is such a thing, beauty and strangeness, coupled with an ever-present poetic sense. Whatever merits and different merits other composers had had before or have had since, this is his contribution to English music. And if I may be permitted to say so, considering what has gone on in the world in the last 50, 60 years, and what is still going on and likely to go on for some time, it is the most valuable contribution that can possibly be imagined. The most fitting, the most timely, the most necessary, and one for which we should all be profoundly grateful.